Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRTLP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime at kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan, I'm your host. Thank you for tuning in today. Sometimes I think of the December holidays as the weekend for the entire year. Normal routines loosen up, people do things to help our fellow humans. Maybe we take stock of the year and what we've done or haven't done. We see friends we haven't seen in a while, and maybe we enjoy the sparkle and the lights. So today's show arrives in that spirit of being a little different. No civic issues today. Instead, I'm reconnecting with a friend I haven't talked with in decades. Here's the backstory. 50 years ago this month, I was in a play in high school. The play was 12 Angry Jurors, which was also a movie in the 1950s known as 12 Angry Men. By the 70s, people had wised up. It wasn't smart to limit this to one gender. Anyway, the story depicts a jury trying to decide if a teenager accused of murder is guilty. Most jurors quickly say yes, but there's a holdout, and the play shows the conflict and how it resolves. I liked my castmates. I suspect they were more important to me than they knew. A couple years ago, I thought, well, what if we could reassemble the cast and stage a reading of the play 50 years later as a benefit for something meaningful in our hometown, Saratoga? I dropped that thought as impractical and then wondered, well, what else could I do with this idea? I thought, maybe I can talk with someone from the cast, specifically today's guest, Teresa Ozoa. Why her? I think that'll become clear as we talk. She's been a teacher and a lawyer, two professions that ought to resonate with listeners in Davis, where education and lawmaking are major occupations. We'll talk about that. But I also hope to talk with her about her work, her discoveries, what that long-ago cast and play might mean to her now. And although you might not know the play or anything about us, perhaps the discussion will evoke your own past moments when you did something with your friends. On a team, a project, in a class, whenever or whatever, right before you launched into adulthood. Maybe you'll recall people you've been lucky to know who are trying to figure out the same questions of life you might have faced as you faced them. Teresa, thanks for joining us today, and thanks also for agreeing to talk with me as I record you. That shows spunk.
My pleasure. It's great to connect again after all these years.
I'm enjoying this tremendously already. But okay, so would you start by just saying a little bit about yourself, podium level introductory stuff, where you live, your occupation, maybe your philosophy of life, if you have that boiled down?
I'm going to start by where I am presently, which is retired from the teaching profession. I had already decided in October of 2019, I guess, that I was going to retire in 2020. And as fate would have it, my very last day in a high school English classroom was Friday the 13th of 2020 when the world shut down. So I was obviously a high school English teacher. That was my first profession and then my third profession. After high school, I attended Stanford University and obtained a teaching credential and Bachelor in English, Master in Education, and I student taught at our alma mater, Saratoga High School. Taught for a few years, including a brief stint in Hawaii, and then went to UCLA Law School, which is where I met my wonderful husband, Larry Ebener. I practiced law for about, gosh, 11 years, I guess. Then Larry and I are not nanny people, so once we started having children, one of us had to not work 80 hours a week. And so I was elected, and I went back into the classroom, which ironically was a lot of hours a week, especially when I moved from elementary to high school, teaching English and grading essays. So during that time, I developed a bit of a specialty in educational technology. So, even more than my Stanford degree, I'm very proud of having become a Google certified educator and did some professional development. And now that I'm retired, I feel like my identity, we'll talk about this, I'm sure, has really shifted. Back then, it was all about kind of adding to my quiver of tools for enjoying my profession. But now I'm really enjoying retirement and think a lot less about the work world. So that's me in a nutshell.
So you described a lot of the phases of life there, all the way back from when you got started to having kids. Yeah, it did strike me when you said you took the job of teaching with the idea that it would be fewer hours. I've never taught, but the teachers I know, I think they would agree with your final assessment that that really was a lot of work.
Well, my husband calls me the most successfully downwardly mobile person that he knows. I went from a high power, large law firm to eventually part time in education and then full time. I slowly built my salary level back up. But yeah, teachers don't do it for the money, for sure.
Is the way your life turned out professionally, I'm talking about now, is that what you thought it would when you were in high school? Did you th think law, think teaching?
Well, broad strokes, it did. I expected to have a family and have a profession, but really having family as being the focus, and that has certainly been borne out. I've always been a teacher. I remember in when my little sister was, I don't know, probably kindergarten, I taught her how to write the word toothpaste, which she did with great glee in permanent marker on one of our desk chairs. So from even that time, I think I did the what color is your parachute business, as everybody did, and teaching came out as one of the big areas of focus for me. My parents were both physicians in Saratoga, where we grew up, and expected me, eldest daughter. My parents weren't tiger moms, but since I had decent academics, they expected me to follow them into medicine, which I started as pre-med, and then physics was my downfall. And I thought, I'm going to do something easy. And English was the easiest and the most pleasurable for me. So I did that and then moved into teaching and then law after that.
I found an article written about you when you were retiring. Now, this is from University High School in Irvine, California. So it's from 2020. And I want to quote from part of it here. One student in Ozawa's Expository Reading and Writing course, Senior Branton Lucas, recalls her unique teaching style as a memorable and devoted educator. Quote, "She's a bright, inspiring woman. She's helped me develop a 3D perspective when it comes to making an assumption. Every single day for 2 years, we as a class would work on this warm-up named Baby Animal. At first, I was naive and confused, but slowly I trusted it and saw what it helped me with. I can't thank her enough for that silly but effective way of learning." Okay, well, first, this kind of sounds like the way I remember you, creative and surprising and effective, but I'm very curious to know what this baby animal thing was that proved so useful. What is that?
It evolved from 3D to 3V for point of view, three views, and is now out in the world as an edu protocol. One of my early mentors, John Carippo, who's based in, I guess, near Fresno, has created this empire of educational strategies called edu protocols, and I think he calls it 3V goggles or 3V vision. But the idea is to essentially ask the question about anything or make the statement, or maybe. So what I would do is project on my screen a picture of a baby animal, because I heard a TED Talk where apparently we love baby animals because they promote endorphins and all that. And I wanted, it was pure emotional manipulation. I wanted my students, whenever they walked into my room, first walked in the room, to love being there. So I always had a baby animal. But then I'd ask them, and this could last anywhere from a minute to a unit, but I'd ask them to first describe factually what you see. Then what would a person who finds that image positive be thinking? Why? What would a person who finds that image negative be thinking and why? And then ask a question. So the three V's are positive, negative, and ask a question. For example, one of my favorite images was of a little ginger kitten in the palm of someone's hand. And they would say, oh, that's a kitten. Well, what's a kitten? Oh, that's a baby cat. Well, a cat is, oh, it's a mammal, got 4 legs, got fur. And we know it's a kitten because it fits in what looks like the palm of an adult person's hand. It's probably a staged shot because the background is very muted, like it was in a studio, not someone's, quick Instagram shot. And most people would see the image and go, "Oh, I love kittens." And they had trouble figuring out why would anyone see this as negative. And they would delve further and think, okay, well, maybe someone's allergic. So they have very negative associations of kittens. For me, I read a book called It's Like This Cat, obviously very dated, but it was on the Newbery Award winner list. And I went through that entire bookmark. I don't know if you remember getting those bookmarks of, and that was one of the books. And long story short, the protagonist visited a cat lady in her house, was stepping backwards. She had a million cats and heard a crunch, and he had stepped on a ginger kitten, blood, awfulness, which I don't need to go into detail. So that's my association with a ginger kitten, very negative. And then the question that most people ask is, what does ginger mean? Oh, ginger. Oh, yeah, Ed Sheeran. Yeah, he's a ginger. He's red-haired. So it's one of those orange cats. And when you apply this to anything, I find it develops empathy. So, for example, someone cuts you off on the freeway, you could go, "Oh, what a jerk. I'm angry. He's just trying to get somewhere fast." Or maybe he just had an epileptic seizure and was having trouble driving, and actually he needs our help and our sympathy. And then the question would be, okay, that's a Toyota Prius. How can he possibly be going that fast? So when we apply this to even, road rage, or what one of my neighbors is thinking with having a particular flag or placard up on their house, it creates empathy because you say, well, okay, maybe they're a jerk, or maybe there's some story there that makes it completely rational and understandable that they hold a view that's different from my first assumption. So I've spun this out into entire units to do points of view.
I can see how you did because I mean you've gotten a lot of mileage there just out of a kitten and a hand. You're right. Most people would go, oh, that's cute. And particularly with social media, you can see a million videos like that every day. But you see you're launching that into a whole discussion about what are you really seeing here? What might really be going on? And then I suppose at some point you arrive at some kind of conclusion, right? I mean, not necessarily a single conclusion. Or is the point just to make sure that people are thinking there's more than one side to an issue?
It's the latter, and I condense this down to simply asking, or maybe. And I find that when I've done that, and when students like Branton have done that, it really fosters empathy, that rather than having a knee-jerk reaction, that we automatically recognize that there's an alternative point of view. So, yeah, I usually didn't have a particular conclusion, and reasonable minds could differ on how cute a ginger kitten is. So, move on to analyzing Pride and Prejudice after that.
I gotta say, the idea of stepping on a ginger kitten as part of a story, that is pretty dark. That took a dark turn there.
Oh, it was mortifying, and
A
that's why it stuck with me.
couple of other things from your teaching career. You adopted the Genius Hour. This is an idea from Google in your contemporary studies literature class. Can you explain what that was?
Way back in the day, Google used to do something called 20% time. Employees would work for Google for 80% of their time, and then 20% of the time, they would do whatever they wanted and still get paid. And out of that came innovations like Gmail, innovations like Google Wave, which has since gone by the wayside, but that was very, very innovative. AdSense, I think, came out of that. And they have since condensed it down to, I think, the privilege of being in a moonshot workshop. So instead of only choosing themselves what to do outside of their normal work, they would have to pitch an idea and maybe be part of a team for a couple of months to do this moonshot thinking, shoot for the moon. What would you do if you had unlimited resources, or how would you tackle X problem? Which is probably the only way to foster innovation, really. You have to give people the time and space to imagine how things could be rather than being overwhelmed by the way things are. So the way that what that looks like in education, or with me, was my giving students basically one day a week to do research on whatever the heck they wanted. They had to do two things. One, they had to document their progress, their research, their iterations, their failures, successes. And secondly, they had to do a presentation of whatever kind they wanted. It was usually just something in class. One of the most popular things was to write a travel blog or a cooking website to prepare for college. I did have one girl who learned the ukulele during the course of, I think it was probably a semester, but I also had a couple of students, one who ran a photography contest for high school students. They entered their photo and she compiled every single one of them into, I think it was probably an 8x8 photo, so she could put it into a book. I think she published just like two of them. She got a mentor. Oh yeah, they had to have a mentor. That's the third requirement, who happened to be an Insta-famous photographer who was actually a freshman in college to be the judge of the competition. And she got the OC Weekly, Orange County Weekly, to put up some money for prizes. So $100 for the first prize winner, and then 50 and 25, I think. And one of the editors from the paper came to actually present the check. So lots of different amazing things came out of that. And you'll probably ask, how does this work with diverse populations like special ed kids? And one of my favorite stories about that is two boys. No, that was the second favorite. First favorite was Joey, who was researching armament and munitions. And in the lab one day, mumbled under his breath, gosh, if I did this in my old school, I'd probably get arrested. But the day of his presentation, we had technical difficulties and he couldn't do his PowerPoint. And I said, Joey, we can do this tomorrow. And he goes, no, this is all. I got this. And he sat on my big chair and he pontificated for 15 minutes about armaments and historical weapons. It was brilliant. And the kids really enjoyed it. And he got some different kind of cred for his interest in the work he did. So magical things can happen when you give kids ownership over their own research.
A quick station ID. We are talking with Teresa Ozoa. We've been talking a lot about her role as a teacher, but the particular reason for this is that she and I were in the same play 50 years ago this month. This is Davisville, KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California. I'm Bill Buchanan. Well, Teresa, I do want to talk about the play a little bit, 12 Angry Jurors. I hadn't done drama before that senior year. I don't know if you had either. I don't recall. But I hadn't. It was something brand new. I was in it. In theater groups like that, you can quickly develop a camaraderie because here you are all struggling together to put on something. You're going to do it in front of your friends and family. You want to do something good, at the very least, not embarrass yourself. Does that play mean anything to you now, 50 years later? What do you remember?
Absolutely, it does. And I had been involved in drama, mostly the musicals and plays with Miss Judy Seton. And I found drama really a wonderful outlet for an introvert such as I. I think one reason many performers are self-described introverts is they feel like they would like to get lost in their role, as opposed to constantly projecting whoever it is that they are, they're supposed to be. And that was certainly the case for me. But that was one of my most memorable experiences of high school, I think, because all of us except for the bailiff, Dan Fernandez, were seniors. And he was, a very involved in drama. And so he knew everybody who was in the play. I don't know if you recall, we went, I think it was a dinner, went to dinner before dress rehearsal in character.
I do
And
remember,
you,
yeah.
Bill, who was one of the antagonists, actually got into it with the other primary character. What do you remember about that? It was an Italian restaurant, I think.
Yeah, it was an Italian restaurant. So yeah, there were the 12 of us, 13 when Dan was along. And I do think one or two, I think Marilee Mountson might have been a junior in the, but anyway, we all went to dinner
Oh, you're
and
right, Marilee. That's correct.
And anyway, we're supposed to be in character. I think the director, Judy Sutton, had told us to do that. Well, you're being somebody you aren't in a restaurant. And I have kind of a Midwestern background, want to be very polite. Well, you get to this thing and you're supposed to be who you are. So there's members of the cast who are pugnacious. There are members who are quick to judgment. And that was the one. I was supposed to be, my part was the Henry Fonda part in the movie. I was the holdout. And Jeff Loudon, Hadley Loudon, as he goes by now, that's his middle name, was one of the antagonists. And we actually, yeah, we kind of got going. And I remember the waitress being a little concerned. Here are these 12 teenagers taking up a lot of space. And it sounds like something is starting. What I don't remember is if we ever explained ourselves to her afterwards and said,
I don't either, but I do remember we left before any authority figures came to ask us to leave. But I do also remember I was number 11, which was the ethnic immigrant juror, and my good friend was an elderly person who was Karen Robinson, and she was juror number 12. So we sat next to each other, and that was my experience, was observing, just as it would have been in the jury room too. But I loved that play, and it was, let's see, I don't even remember if I was in anything after that, in because I think that was the fall play, and then we had a spring one. But yeah, it was great fun, and I think about that often because those were good friends, and I followed the careers of a couple of them down in Southern California.
some did go into acting. Karen Robinson ended up teaching in Atlanta, teaches drama.
And Gigi Birmingham was actually in Black Panther. She was the UN representative from France, speaking very fluently in French.
It's kind of
And
fun. You can look up her IMDb listing for her and a couple others. We all know each other, but if anyone just listening to this thinks, okay, well, that wasn't my experience, you may know people who have gone out and done things. And I guess that was the subtext for me. It's a time of big changes, that time of life. And I want to mention this. College loomed, and this is what I meant at the start of the show when I said the cast meant more to me maybe than people realized. Because as you might recall, during that rehearsals, right before the play went on, my oldest brother John died in a commercial plane crash. And I think most people wanted the show to continue, even though life suddenly seemed very, very foreign to me. And so this is one of the moments I remember. I remember coming to one of the final cast run-throughs. It was in the band room, so we weren't in the theater yet. I'd come straight from the reception for my brother's funeral, and I was numb, I was unhappy, I was disoriented. And when I opened the door there in the band room, everyone applauded. And I'm a writer. I've worked as a writer all my life. I still don't know how to fully express how moving that was for me. The point is, it was a vivid time of life. It was a vivid moment. And I've carried that forward all my years since then. You talk about empathy, understanding, being sort of open to other people, realizing what people are doing for you. It was pretty important, pretty profound. And so that's one reason I've always thought about the play. I remember also going on stage in the play and about to speak my part, and my whole right side goes numb. I'd never been on a play before, and I thought, but it worked, because you've rehearsed it enough. There's muscle memory. I'm hoping people have had not that particular experience I had, of course, but experiences like that. And you've taught high school. Again, not that specific kind of a moment, but do you see those kinds of connections taking place among your students?
Absolutely. They're the clearest to observe as an outsider in times of crisis. And unfortunately, during the school year, we had an incident involving a young man who took his own life. And that next morning, I remember, was the blood drive. And we had a quick faculty meeting before school to get all the facts on the incident and to make sure to know where to refer kids who needed help. And I remember giving blood that day, and it took them forever to find a vein. I learned later that the number of pints they took was way lower than usual. And one of my science nerds said, "Well, of course, we're under stress, fight or flight. Your circulation tends to pull in from your extremities into the center of your body. So, of course, it would be very, very difficult to donate blood." And I think the entire campus reacted in a similar way to that moment of crisis. But I also knew of students who had their own tragedies and losses who relied on their friends. And I've had more than my share of, "Hey, if you need to step outside or I'll give you a pass. You can go see the counselor or whatever. So high school was a really interesting and is an interesting environment that seems to magnify the emotions of things like that. And as you say, it's transitional. It's a microcosm of what we all expect to experience in life. And hopefully it's not so traumatic for people, but even if it isn't personally traumatic, we're exposed to that in that close community of high school.
Yeah, maybe it's a time of life you start making sense of it. Particularly if you do have friends, people you can talk to about it. We're very near the end. Do you go to any of the high school reunions? I can't say I have, but I've cut them off the radar, frankly.
I attended two of them, and Hadley, as I used to call him just as a joke in high school, has been one of the main planners because he's remained in the area and was very social. I did not go to this last one because it was in late September, and we were expecting our first grandbaby in early October, so I didn't plan to travel anywhere during that time. But I have kept up with a number of people through just random connections on Facebook, and some who weren't in our class, but who I may have known at Stanford, who are maybe a year ahead or a year below. And it's kind of arbitrary. I mean, these were not necessarily good friends of mine during high school, but when you learn about, oh, we're moving to Florida, or my kids just got married, or we had this travel experience, you feel like you know a little bit about your contemporaries. And I find that really, and sometimes people reach out for interviews.
Well, like
And
this, for example.
it's
People with radio shows calling out of the blue saying, "Hey." Well, Teresa, this has been a delight. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. It reminds me in a way of some of the conversations that, we had those cast parties, where we'd all sit around and
absolutely.
talk and chew over the problems of the world, what we hope to do, things like that. It's nice for me to have those kinds of conversations now, half a century later. Because life is about the
Well,
whole
I
experience,
appreciate, yeah. I totally appreciate this experience, and it makes me want to go out and connect more with other people as well. But I also recognize as time goes by that we don't have to grab onto every single experience that I thought I had to when I was young. I can just sort of let it flow and enjoy whatever I'm enjoying and not have FOMO, fear of missing out, because I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I'm not missing out on anything.
One riposte, I guess I heard to FOMO was JOMO,
Joy.
joy of missing out. It's like, hey, I don't have to do that one. It might be great, but I'd rather just stay home with a book or whatever. Well,
Exactly.
Teresa, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Teresa Ozoa, retired teacher, retired lawyer. We hardly touched on that, but she was a lawyer, and we were classmates years ago and in a play at our high school. So, Teresa, thanks again. And thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Bill Buchanan, Davisville, KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California. Thank you for listening.